Joining us on the line now is Andrew Gilmore. He joined the UN in 1989 and spent most of the next 30 years working on conflict in Afghanistan, Iraq, South Sudan, the Middle East, West Africa and the Balkans. In 2016, he was appointed UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights. He's now Executive Director of the Berghof Foundation, the oldest and largest independent organisation working on peace and conflict issues in Germany. His book, The Burning Question, looks at the connections between climate and conflict and why they matter. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us. So tell us about your time with the UN. You were with them for many years then.
Absolutely. Usually in the field, but also at times at headquarters. And but in terms of climate, most of the time, most of the issues we were involved with didn't appear at that time to be especially climate related.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about the Berghof Foundation? How long have you been there?
I've been here for 4 years, and we work on a number of conflicts, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Sudan, Somalia, and many others.
And when did you kind of make that connection then between climate issues and conflict?
Well, it was really in my last job at the UN, where, as you kindly said, I was the head of human rights at UN headquarters. And it's that where I began to see how much human rights and climate issues were related, that I hadn't really twigged before to the extent to which the sort of the threat of climate change it basically is in every aspect of one's life, and therefore including human rights. But also, it gradually dawned on me the link between climate change and many of the conflicts that we deal with.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, I would say, well, actually, it's several. Essentially, the whole swathe of the Sahel from Mali in the west all the way to through Sudan and Somalia on the Red Sea, but then also Yemen and Afghanistan, and particularly perhaps Iraq and Syria, where you would find often, and it doesn't have to be climate change manifested by droughts and desertification, but in many cases it is. And one can see that in places, whether it's Boko Haram in Nigeria or Al-Qaeda in the Sahel in Mali or Al-Shabaab in Somalia, that these are all places that are especially badly hit by conflict, that were already incredibly poor in almost all cases. But then it sort of leads to, as this competition literally heats up over scarce resources such as agricultural land and water, tensions grow up, and it leads also to the rise in the attractiveness of extremist groups.
Yeah, it's unfair, I guess, is one word for it, when you have areas that you mentioned that are experiencing conflict and poverty that are also suffering with issues to do with climate change. You know, there's a lot going on in a lot of these places.
Well, it's especially unfair, and you've chosen exactly the right word, and it's related to the whole concept of climate justice, in the sense that these countries that we're talking about have contributed almost nothing to actual climate change, i.e. they haven't been emitting, unlike industrialized countries like my own, the UK, that started the first industrial revolution in the 1850s, and similarly other industrialized countries emitting vast amounts of greenhouse gases. But these countries that are the most affected by climate change are also those that are least responsible for the climate change that they are suffering. And we, relatively speaking, we in industrialized countries are suffering much less, even though it is our responsibility.
Mm. So how do you kind of get people in the more westernized countries that you mentioned to care and to understand more about the connection with the other countries?
Well, that is the huge question. How do you get people to care? And of course, at a time when there is sort of compassion fatigue, there are so many conflicts. There are more conflicts going on at the moment than at any time since 1945. And moreover, some of them are especially bloody and extremely high casualty figures, especially in Gaza. But how to get people to care about these things is a very key question, not least because we are going to face, and we should not shy from it, even though it is politically incredibly sensitive, that there are going to be vastly greater numbers of people fleeing countries that are now literally becoming uninhabitable because of the rising heat, but also because of the conflict that comes from the rising heat. So they will be on the move. And I think getting electorates to understand that they are going to come, whatever we can do, we can talk in the most apocalyptic terms about what we're going to do about closing our borders and all of that. But I think it's going to be very, very hard, because when it basically it dawns on people that actually the conditions that many people are going to be living in are totally uninhabitable at some point. We haven't reached that stage yet, although we are getting that way. I think people will actually start understanding that, especially since it is our emissions that are largely responsible for it, that we're going to have to be a lot more generous in allowing people to come.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. So what are people supposed to do then, for anybody listening who's saying, okay, I get it, we need to be doing more. What should the everyday person be doing?
Well, I mean, frankly, it's not so much the everyday person. I mean, cutting people's own carbon footprint is very important, but this isn't going to actually have an impact on this particular aspect. I think it is mainly pressure on governments, first of all, to increase assistance to help these countries, because the ones that we're talking about are the ones in conflict and the poorest and the ones least responsible. So at the very least, they need investment in their countries to actually enable the people to carry on living there, even though the temperatures are getting hotter. And the whole global climate finance architecture is terribly unsatisfactory in this regard. I mean, believe it or not, the countries that are most vulnerable receive only 1% per capita of what countries that are less vulnerable are getting in terms of climate finance. But that is just insane, because the people who most need it are the people getting by far the least assistance. And so we have to change that system, whereby aid should be targeted more at the countries that are most in need.
Mm-hmm. There are still people who don't believe in climate change and don't think that it actually is something that is happening, and don't take it seriously at all. What would you say to them?
I mean, there are not that many people, frankly, and certainly there's almost none in the scientific community. One would reason with them to say, well, please do look at the evidence. This is not a hoax. And to suggest otherwise, and of course, and the people who should really be targeted here are the purveyors of false news, like the Murdoch press, and particularly in the United States, Fox News, that continually casts doubt about climate change. And of course, there are others as well. There's the Daily Telegraph stable in the United Kingdom and others as well. But on the whole, I mean, these are the people, because in many cases, they know very well that what they're saying is untrue. So I think one has to slightly raise the cost for those who are purveying false news and pretending that this is not a true phenomenon.
Mm. And the obviously connection between climate change and political change is huge. You know, I think people are understanding more, as you say, that the governments need to be doing more to make these changes.
Governments certainly need to be doing more, but there are aspects that the private sector and that the large companies can do as well. And it is an interesting factor that there is a rise in climate litigation, i.e. people, either shareholder activists or just people who are victims of climate change, are suing some of the large corporations who are most responsible for climate change. And I think actually that is an encouraging development, because the one thing that will affect the behavior of these large corporations is being hit by large lawsuits. And some of them are actually warning their shareholders that these lawsuits are damaging their business model. And I think that is an encouraging step, actually. It may be alarming for the shareholders, but it's pretty good news for the planet.
Yeah. And when you decided to put this book together and to do all the research for the book, were you surprised in the information that you found?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. I think anybody who's doing research should be a little bit surprised. I don't think anything particularly leapt out at me. I had to gradually reach the conclusion before doing the hardcore research that this was a real phenomenon, and that then the ways that I suggested in it, that I suggest in this book, for example, environmental peace building, trying to that I realized that it is more a thing, as it were, than I had thought otherwise. And then this is a very important thing. It means that we can try to start working on peaceful solutions between communities in conflict with one another by trying to choose a common problem, often related to the environment or climate, and getting people to work collaboratively on something for a joint sort of win-win solution. And I think that this is, I think I was surprised by how much potential there is in this practice of environmental peace building.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Making, taking action against climate change without creating further conflict. You know, we're trying to risk reduce the risk of conflict rather than creating more.
And that is another key point, because it is vital that the measures we take, because you see, climate change can create conflict either directly, as I said, by just countries on the front line of conflict, of climate change, are also those that are feeling the impact most directly. But you can also feel it indirectly, by which I mean the measures we take to combat climate change. And we have to be very conflict sensitive when we come up with measures. For example, we don't want to suddenly, we have seen how the farmers' protests in Europe, I wouldn't say this is a stage of full-on conflict, although there have been, for example, with the Gilets Jaunes about 6 years ago in France, there was certainly violence attached. But I think one could see much more when we're talking about measures that are taken in good faith to reduce carbon emissions, create tremendous resentments among the people who feel that they are losing out, for example, through the rise of diesel fuel, which is what rural areas protested bitterly about in France. And so it is very important. And one can see that there are countries such as Nigeria or Iraq where government revenues are overwhelmingly dependent on the fossil fuels that are produced. And there's basically, they have like a social contract with their population, and they need that revenue to be able to provide basic social services to populations. And if those populations don't receive this basic social services, they may well take up weapons, as they often do when basic services are cut.
Yeah. Do you think there's some countries that are dealing with the climate change situation much better than others?
Yes. I mean, it's hard to say that there's some that they're really doing well. I think almost everywhere there is basically governments have not accepted the full implications of what's happening. Of course, some in Europe are making bigger efforts to reduce emissions. But in terms of preparing populations for what's coming, I think there has been a pretty inadequate general sort of civic education program to get people to get awareness, particularly the point I was raising earlier, the idea that this will mean, and I'm sorry to tell you guys who don't want a lot of immigration, it's going to happen. There is just simply, but very few political parties have the courage to do that. And I slightly see why, because they think they're going to get hammered at the next election. And we'll probably be seeing that in the European elections in the next couple of months. But nevertheless, politicians are going to have to take the courage at some point and speak frankly to their electorates.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if people want to find out more information on the subject, they should definitely get a copy of your book, The Burning Question, Climate and Conflict, Why Does It Matter? It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Andrew Gilmore, who we've been chatting with today. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.